We talk about the housing market in this country as one coherent beast. The fact is, not all home sales are created equal, you know. We'll tell you about that. Also, our series, I've Always Wondered. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl, the 23rd day of December, Wednesday. Good as always to have you with us, everybody. With apologies to Charles Dickens, we will begin today with a tale of two markets. The best of the housing market, the worst of the housing market, or something like that. We learned yesterday that existing home sales for November, used homes, is another way to think about that. We're down more than 10%. That's the biggest drop in 5 years in that particular market. But then today, numbers from the Census Bureau showed that new home sales were actually up more than 4% last month. So we are going to focus on that because even though they're a small sliver of all homes bought and sold in this country, those new homes mean a whole lot for the wider economy. Marketplace's Andy Euler is on it.
All right. The first thing you need to know is
new homes are a different beast than existing homes.
That's Ralph McLaughlin, a housing economist with Trulia.
They require a lot of different inputs. They require a lot of different planning. And ultimately, they require demand from the public.
He says new home sales in particular provide a bigger economic engine for the economy. What some might see as a number, others see as different strands of the economy at work. Morris Davis teaches real estate at Rutgers.
Not just the number of units, it's people building the units. How big are the units that are being built?
Think carpenters, plumbers, electricians. Because the bigger the house, the more folks you need swinging hammers and putting up 2x4s. And when you finally close on the house,
then there's furniture, groceries that you want to fill the refrigerator with. It's not like people are eating more, but there's another fridge that might be filled with more groceries.
And there's probably a lot more people looking to fill those fridges. New home sales are up more than 14% this year. Rafael Bostic teaches real estate at USC. He thinks these numbers actually do shed some light on how people feel about the economy.
And now when you talk to home builders, they're pretty optimistic. So I think that it's actually a sign of some confidence in where the economy is and where it's likely to go.
But it's also probably more expensive to buy one of those new homes these days. The median price in November was $305,000, up almost 1% from last year. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Here with a story about Disney that has nothing to do with the incredible success of Star Wars, awesome as it was. No, today the entertainment conglomerate is in the news over its plan to sell off its stake in Fusion, the multicultural, multi-platform media company it launched with Univision a couple of years ago. The idea was to reach millennials, an idea that has so far failed to catch on. And that, oh, by the way, is not all that's not working so well at Disney these days. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour reports.
Fusion is a cable network and an online news source, and it started as a way to reach young English-speaking Hispanics.
That did not work.
Porter Bibb is with MediaTek Capital Partners.
They went through several permutations, rejigging the content, and ended up just going after millennials in general.
That didn't work either.
The network is popularly known as Confusion because it really confused the viewers.
Plus, marketing a cable channel to a generation that doesn't really watch cable is hard in general. And Disney thinks it'll have better luck partnering with Vice News, where it's already invested $400 million. Dade Hayes is editor of Broadcasting and Cable Magazine.
It's so crowded out there to reach an audience that is already cutting the cord, and it's hit a variety of different companies hard.
Including other parts of Disney. As fewer people watch cable, Disney's crown jewel, ESPN, is losing millions of viewers. At the same time, ESPN has paid through the nose for sports licensing fees. Investors have been dumping Disney stock for a month. William Smead is CEO of Smead Capital Management. He says they're overreacting.
From a historical standpoint, fears like this are wiggles.
He argues the issue here isn't Disney content, it's how to get that content to viewers who probably do want it.
Great content survives all the distribution systems. The distribution systems are the biggest risks.
Radio, TV, cable, internet, the Magic Kingdom is still standing. Oh, also Star Wars, the movie that made $690 million in a week. Yeah, Disney made that. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Star Wars. All right, a pause now for today's Marketplace moment in economic history before we move on. Today is, as I believe I set up on top, December the 23rd. That ring a bell for anybody? No? What if I gave you a hint? Say, Janet Yellen? That do it? Still no? All right, here you go. Today in 1913, Woodrow Wilson signed the Federal Reserve Act into law. I thought that was interesting. And now you know. Look where we are, by the way, with the Fed. Wall Street Today, the rally of Santa Claus has arrived. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Flights are crowded. There's the scramble to board first to snag space for your bag, which you're dragging on board in the first place to avoid the baggage fee. And no matter how carefully you pack, the thing barely fits in the overhead. There has got to be a better way. Thankfully, we've got just the thing. Today's installment of our series, I've Always Wondered.
If you wonder...
By asking 1,000 questions to get one answer, by brain work and blade work.
Hutch Humphreys sent us this question from San Diego.
I was wondering what research has gone into the various algorithms airlines use for boarding passengers and why most of those algorithms do not seem to work very well.
Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman is on that one.
Mainly, airlines board the way they do to save time, which is money. They want to turn the plane around as quickly as possible, avoid delays and extra labor costs. Secondly, they want to use boarding as a perk. Treat the fancy flyers, business and first class, gold club, sky team, and all the rest, a little better than everyone else in the cheap seats. So I've come to Portland International Airport on a busy weekday. Alaska Airlines, United, and Delta are boarding flights. And they all do it the same basic way. Expensive seats and VIPs first, then the main cabin. Delta has everyone in coach board at once, sort of in a clump. United does it in order of windows, middle, and then aisle seats. Alaska boards back to front by zones. I ask gate agent Francis Sheehan what gums up the process.
Too many bags.
Carry-on bags. They're the bane of boarding. These days, everyone's trying to avoid checked bag fees. Overheads fill up, lines stop moving. Alaska now has a computer program that calculates exactly how many carry-ons need to be checked at the gate to avoid that pileup. And there's a certain passenger type to watch out for, says airport spokesperson Kama Simons.
Even if they know they have an hour and a half before boarding, they're a gate hugger. They want to stay right at that gate, so...
Gate huggers? I mean, is that a sort of airport argo?
We'll call it an affectionate industry term.
Those anxious gate huggers, they can also be line jumpers, rushing to the front right when boarding starts, blocking everyone else. Discount carrier Southwest avoids all this with a unique open seating method. Passengers line up based on how early they checked in. Once on the plane, there are no assigned seats. It's first come, first serve. Bianca Momond, a regular on Southwest, is waiting for her flight for Oakland.
I can tell people who don't travel Southwest get really confused by it, even though it seems like an easy system. I don't mind it.
Passenger Matt Phillips does mind, though.
I like to know where my seat's going to be. And
even if you can only get a middle seat and it's by the bathroom.
At least I know what I'm getting into. I feel like at Southwest, I'm always rolling the dice.
At least it's a fair roll, says Southwest spokesman Brad Hawkins.
Once you get on the airplane, it's just like church or the movies. It's a very egalitarian experience.
Also efficient. Checked bags fly free on Southwest, so there are fewer carry-ons. And the airline has among the best boarding times in the industry. But couldn't it be even better? Astrophysicist Jason Steffen at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas thinks so.
The algorithm that I use to kind of find the optimum boarding method is called Markov chain Monte Carlo.
Steffen decided to run some experiments after he got frustrated with boarding delays, starting with that Markov chain Monte Carlo.
You set up a scenario, you make random changes to it. If the random change is an improvement, then you keep the change. And if the random change is not an improvement, then you keep the change sometimes.
Steffen's research next took him to Hollywood.
To the studio where they filmed Airplane. They had 72 seats. We got 72 extras. They all had some luggage. Turned out that boarding in blocks from back to front took about twice as long to fill the airplane as my method.
And his method? board the plane back to front, every other row, alternating sides, windows first, then middle seats and aisles. It's complicated and kind of antisocial, splitting up families and friends for boarding. But it is efficient because it spreads passengers out so they can find their seats, stow their luggage, and sit down already. One more thing Stefan found in his research, even if airlines simply boarded planes randomly,
to say, okay, everyone, airplane's open, go ahead and get on board,
that would also be faster than what they do now, because people who get in line randomly aren't likely to have adjacent seats and be fighting over the same overhead bins before settling down to fly. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
This series, as with so much we do on this radio program, does not work without you. So ask us what you've always wondered about on our website. Maybe we'll answer it and get you on the radio. It's marketplace.org. Nobody wants bad things to happen, whether it's natural disasters or financial ones. But what does happen when crisis prevention takes risk right out of the equation? Greg Ipp has spent some time pondering that. He's the chief economics commentator at the Wall Street Journal, and his new book is called Foolproof: Why Safety Can Be Dangerous and How Danger Makes Us Safe. Greg, thanks for coming on.
Thanks very much for having me.
Can we make ourselves safe? The message here is maybe we don't want to.
It's a complicated question, but there's no doubt that oftentimes when we're trying to make our economy, our environment, ourselves safer, we're actually doing things that may make us complacent or take more different risks and end up having different types of disasters. That was the story of the financial crisis. We dealt with the risks we knew, like inflation and recessions and bank failures. And in the process, we encouraged people to think that we had made recessions and financial crises things of the past and encouraged them to take more risk. Just think about driving on a snowy road with snow tires. You have more traction, so you drive a little bit faster, which works great until you spin out and then your accident is worse.
Let me get you back to the financial crisis, though. Are we safer today for having gone through the crisis? I mean, because there's going to be another one, right? Nobody doubts that there's going to be another crisis sometime.
There absolutely is going to be another crisis. And one of the points I want to emphasize is that crises result from taking risks. And risk-taking is something that is not bad. It's actually good. It's why people take chances on new innovations, new businesses. We can't have a system that gets rid of all possibility of crisis. Banks are going to fail. What you want is a system that allows banks to fail without bringing down the rest of the system. And we've got that now with the Dodd-Frank law. Banks thought they had made themselves safer with all sorts of financial innovations like mortgage-backed securities and derivatives. But it turns out they were just transferring those risks to someone else, and the amount of risk in the system was going up. It's far, far better to make banks hold more shareholders' equity, which means it really doesn't matter what kind of mistake they make. That will protect them from the next problem.
Periodic crisis, you write, is the price we pay for long-term safety.
That's right. Let's take a couple examples. The housing bubble obviously resulted in a lot of wreckage. But look back to the 1990s when we had a different type of bubble, the stock market bubble. NASDAQ stocks going to ridiculous prices and valuations, Pets.com, Webvan. Remember those? Who could forget?
That's right.
And it seems like a lot of people lost a lot of money. It was a big waste. But on the other hand, the craze of the internet bubble enabled a lot of companies to lay a lot of fiber optic cable. And then they went bankrupt because they laid too much of it and the prices collapsed. But the availability of all that cheap bandwidth made it possible for all sorts of new businesses to crop up, like Facebook, like cloud computing. So the point I'm trying to make here is that I wouldn't want the Federal Reserve to go around popping bubbles all the time because they might pop the good bubbles as well as the bad ones.
Is it too broad for me to say that we would all be more safe if we were a little bit less safe?
Let me first say that we as a civilization have made tremendous strides in making ourselves healthier, wealthier. We live longer. Few of us die of terrible diseases. Our roads are safer. Our skies are safer. One of the things we need to do is ask ourselves, are we putting the collective society at risk by allowing individuals to take steps that actually might make sense for them? Classic example is antibiotics. If you've got kids and they have a sore throat, you know, you're a worried parent, you might go to the doctor and say, can I just have like an antibiotic now, just in case? Even though we know that most sore throats don't respond to antibiotics because they're caused by viruses. And each family or each parent, by taking an antibiotic unnecessarily out of that sense of caution, contributes to the prevalence of antibiotic resistance germs. And so it is, in a little way, putting all society at risk. Providing us with these safety devices, providing us with environmental stability, it does do a lot of good, actually. It's not a lot of fun going around being afraid all the time that you're going to die in a car crash. It's not a lot of fun actually worrying all the time you're going to lose your money because of a financial crisis. If we insisted that banks never took any risk at all, they wouldn't lend to the businesses who, in the end, will make those innovations and create those jobs and, in the end, make us all wealthier. So I guess it's necessary to have a balance here, to accept the small disasters and make sure we don't allow the big disasters to occur.
Greg Ipp is the chief economics commentator at The Wall Street Journal. His most recent book is called Foolproof. Greg, thanks very much for your time.
Kai, thanks so much for having me.
Coming up.
It's a feeling of a pilgrimage. People make a party out of it. I've had people waiting in line, and they have, like, their wine, and they'll buy some, you know, prosciutto and stuff to sit out there and enjoy it.
That old holiday tradition of waiting in line. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's up 185 points today, about 1%, closed at 17,602. The NASDAQ increased 44 points, 0.9%, finished at 5,045. The S&P 500 gained 25 points, 1.2%, 2,064. Told you about new home sales, right? Up in November, of course, all kinds of businesses involved in housing. On the lumber side of things, Plum Creek Timber climbed 1.6%. Weyerhaeuser? I don't know. Grew 1.5%. Plugging into the appliance sector now, Whirlpool delivered 2.1%. Electrolux stirred up 2.5%. Today, as we mentioned earlier, not much terribly that even Jedi Knights can do about market forces. The latest Walt Disney news that we told you about brought Disney shares down 1.1%. You're listening to Marketplace. Marketplace is listener supported, so please, to keep our coverage relevant and compelling, make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today. Your gift in any amount counts twice thanks to a dollar-for-dollar match from the Candida Fund. Help us keep you up to date and well-informed wherever you are. Donate at marketplace.org by December 31st, and thanks.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. It's a short day on Wall Street. Markets close early. For Santa, it's a long day. The North American Aerospace Defense Command tracks Santa's journey from the North Pole, an annual tradition. And on December 24th, 1923, President Calvin Coolidge lit the first national Christmas tree on the ellipse, a towering balsam fir from Vermont, his home state. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. All right, full disclosure time. I am, in absolutely all honesty, just a terrible present wrapper. No matter how hard I try, anything that I wrap becomes an unappealing hodgepodge of tape and ribbon and usually poorly chosen paper. And while, yes, birthdays and weddings, to pick just two, have their present wrapping traditions, this time of year pretty much takes the cake. So for today's installment of our seasonal series, The Holidays, brought to you by how that tradition started and why it has lasted, from KBIA, Christopher Husted reports.
At the Plaza Shopping Center in Kansas City, customers bring their purchases to Melissa Anderson. She's been wrapping gifts here for 5 years. Today, she's wrapping a box from a clothing store. The off-white paper has ornately interlocking gold lines. She says opening a beautifully wrapped gift is an experience.
Just like, wow, you're almost more appreciative for the time and effort it took to put into wrapping the gift and the gift itself.
In the U.S., gift wrap accounts for $3.2 billion a year in retail sales, according to research by the Hallmark Company. Patty Stracker is the vice president of the National Stationery Show.
The contemporary market has really expanded well beyond sort of the traditional categories of birthday for juvenile or largely seasonal, because the fourth quarter and holiday wrap is really important.
That ritual of wrapping holiday gifts actually started about 100 years ago.
Gift wrap used to be just brown paper, or there were some colors, red and green tissue paper.
Ron Worley is with the Hallmark Visitor Center. He says people used to wrap gifts to protect them. Brothers Joyce C. and Raleigh Hall, the founders of Hallmark, sold that kind of paper at their shop in Kansas City. But during the 1917 holiday season, they ran out. So the famous card company turned to, well, cards. Not exactly the cards themselves, but...
The envelopes were lined with this French paper. Here's some samples of it.
Worley reaches into a protective plastic sleeve and pulls out some original strips of paper Hallmark stuffed into envelopes. They're covered in patterns of flowers and leaves and colors of purple, blue, and orange.
And they went back to the warehouse and brought this out and sold it for 10 cents a sheet. It sold out. So the next year they really stocked up and they sold it for 3 sheets for a quarter and they sold out again. And that year they started making their own gift wrap.
From that point on, the wrapping paper industry grew. In 1956, Hallmark sent a woman around the country to teach Americans how to wrap the perfect present and came up with this video.
Always pick a bow to fit the shape of the box. For instance, for a cylindrical package, try a circle bow.
The bow trend picked up in the 1950s. Gift bags debuted in the 1980s. Today, there is gift wrap on the market that's reusable and biodegradable. Bette David is a master designer in Hallmark's gift presentation studio. Yes, that's a thing. She's showing off the various wrapping paper collections and accessories on the wall at the headquarters shop. She says the industry evolves alongside consumers' tastes.
We're watching HGTV. We're looking at Pinterest a lot, yes, and Instagram, and looking at what's just out in fashion-forward stores.
This isn't your grandmother's wrapping paper anymore, but there is some of that here, too, for traditionalists. It's still one of the hottest items. In Kansas City, I'm Christopher Husted for Marketplace.
This is, as you know, if you listen to this program regularly, and honestly, you know it even if you don't, a big time of year for retailers. Plenty of people in stores, lines at registers, the signs of commerce are everywhere. But there are places where that ordinarily dreadful holiday shopping experience is something special, unique even. Philadelphia's 9th Street Italian Market in South Philly has been offering Italian specialties for more than 100 years, and the weeks before Christmas are special, long lines and all. Emma Jacobs paid a visit.
In the final days before Christmas, Gus Isgro will start arriving at his bakery at 3 a.m. And by then, he says the line of customers will be down the block.
How far does the line go back?
Down to the corner and about sometimes 30, 40 feet. People-wise, literally hundreds.
Isgro's bakery has had its tiny storefront here for 112 years, with glass cases full of cannolis and cookies.
Two and one vanilla chocolate.
Isgro's is such a Philadelphia institution that it filled an order from the Pope when he was here in September. The Secret Service came to pick it up. Gus Isgro is the third generation of his family working at the pastry shop. His sons are the fourth.
The people that wait in line on the holiday are the people that have been waiting in line for years. Traditionally, their great-grandparents came, their grandparents came, their mom and dad came. They waited in line with their mom and dad. Now they're taking their children and grandchildren.
Around Christmas time, Isgro's bakes more than 300 pans of cookies a day. November and December can represent 40% of business for the year. That's because the holidays are about the family table, Michelle Gambino says. She grew up eating fresh ravioli from the market at Thanksgiving and Christmas.
Every year we used to walk down here and get the raviolis because you want that taste. Like that's what you've created that tradition in your house. And your family and your friends and everybody that comes over to share that expects to have that.
Gambino started working in the Italian market for the Business Association 15 years ago. She points out that many shoppers now return to Philadelphia from the suburbs or even from out of state. So that every Christmas season, she watches the business owners ramp up.
Everybody gets just, like, crazy on, like, high. Like, everybody's just, like, running around, and, like, there's lists to be done, and things are, like, people are stocking up.
Some of the Italian groceries with names like De Bruno's and Claudio's will have started ordering their imported products from Italy back in the summer for the holiday rush. Come this time of year, some keep trucks parked nearby with the products that won't fit in their tiny storefronts. Dave Brown is the general manager of Toludo's, which will also have a line down the block.
It's a feeling of a pilgrimage. People make a party out of it. I've had people waiting in line, and they have, like, their wine, and they'll buy some, you know, prosciutto and something to sit out there and enjoy it.
The store specializes in freshly made pastas. Leading up to Christmas, Brown works a 90-hour week to keep the store running smoothly.
I actually rent a refrigerated trailer, and I have it for 2 weeks, and I park it out, you know, outside here. That's what I need to get by with extra refrigeration space. I couldn't function without it.
Because the very worst thing after someone spends time in a long line would be to get up to that counter and find what they're looking for is out of stock. In Philadelphia, I'm Emma Jacobs for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, which right off the bat I will grant you is an imperfect comparison, but it is interesting nonetheless. The investor news website ValueWalk did a chart this week. Oil priced per gallon, and that's important, versus other well-known liquids. With a barrel of oil, at $36 as it is today, crude goes for 83 cents a gallon. Milk is about, I don't know, $2.29, $2.50 maybe at my local Ralph's. Even water is about a buck and a half a gallon jug. Yes, we are talking raw commodity versus finished product here, but still, economics is cool, right? All right, we got to go. Today, the Dow up 185 points, 1%. The NASDAQ up 44 points, 0.9%. The S&P 500 gained 25 points, 0.1%. Remember, short day on Wall Street tomorrow as things wind down for Friday. Chris Clark, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Garrett Lang, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll be back tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.